Welcome back to BioBits and Bytes. Today, we're going to dive deep into something pretty fundamental to how our bodies work.
Okay.
It's called post-translational modifications, or, you know, we can call them PTMs for short.
Right, PTMs.
Yeah. Think of them as like the incredible fine-tuning that happens to proteins after they're initially made, you know, based on the instructions in our genes.
Right.
And you shared a really fascinating collection of sources with us for this deep dive.
Yeah.
We have like everything from, you know, Thermo Fisher Scientific's overview to explanations from Khan Academy, and even Protein Tech chimed in. And then there were these really interesting discussions from Science Direct about the roles that PTMs play in various biological processes and diseases.
Right.
So our mission today is to unpack this complexity. You know, PTMs, they sound kind of complicated, but we want to reveal the key insights about how these modifications dramatically expand the functional possibilities of our proteins. We'll explore what they are, how they happen, and why they are so critical for everything, from just normal cell function all the way to the development of diseases.
Okay.
And you'll see how a relatively small number of genes in our DNA can give rise to an astonishingly diverse proteome.
Yeah.
Thanks in large part to these PTMs.
So really, the proteome is like the entire collection of proteins in a cell or an organism.
Right.
And PTMs are kind of like adding on these extra bells and whistles.
Exactly, like molecular Lego pieces.
Yeah, exactly. So when we talk about post-translational modifications, we're really talking about these changes.
Okay.
These chemical changes that happen to a protein after it has been synthesized.
Right.
From the instructions in our genes.
Exactly.
And as I said, this can involve adding stuff like phosphate groups or sugar molecules, attaching other proteins, cutting out certain parts, or even marking the whole protein for degradation.
Okay.
For recycling.
So it's not just about the initial protein sequence that's dictated by our genes.
Yeah.
That's just the starting point.
It's the blueprint, but then
the
PTMs are like the interior design and the landscaping.
Exactly.
You know, they really make the protein functional.
And this is a major way our bodies create a vast array of proteins with specialized functions.
Right.
Because if you think about it, we have somewhere between 20,000 and 25,000 genes.
Mm.
But the estimated number of functional proteins in our cells is over a million.
Yeah, that's a huge difference.
So that relatively small genome is doing a lot of work.
It is. And it's the PTMs that are helping to create this million-plus strong workforce of specialized proteins.
That's amazing.
It is. Now, it's important to note that PTMs are a primary driver of this proteomic diversity, but they're not the only one.
Oh, okay.
Thermo Fisher Scientific pointed out that there are other things at play as well.
Like what?
Well, things like genomic recombination.
Mm-hmm.
Alternative promoters, which control when and where a gene starts to be read. Variations in where transcription ends. And something called alternative splicing of the RNA message.
Oh, right. Alternative splicing.
Yeah. All of these processes allow a single gene to make multiple different mRNA blueprints.
And each mRNA blueprint usually creates one protein.
Right.
But then you add this extra layer of post-translational modification.
Yeah.
And suddenly, that single protein can be tweaked in so many ways.
It's like having a base model car and then adding different engine spoilers, interiors, and technology packages. You end up with a whole fleet of unique vehicles, each with different capabilities.
That's a great analogy.
And these modifications aren't just superficial either.
Right.
They have a huge impact on what the protein actually does. They can regulate its activity, like turning it on or off.
Oh, okay.
Or making it work faster or slower.
It's like a dimmer switch, almost.
Yeah, exactly. They can also dictate its location within the cell.
So does it stay in the nucleus or does it go to the cytoplasm?
Right. Does it embed itself in a membrane or float around freely? And PTMs also control the protein's interaction.
Interactions.
Yeah. Which other proteins it binds to, or DNA molecules, lipids, small molecules.
So it's like they determine its social network within the cell.
Yeah, exactly. Who it hangs out with and how it interacts with them.
So the proteome isn't just a static collection of molecules. It's constantly changing.
Right.
It's dynamic and responsive.
It is. It's like a bustling city constantly adapting to new information and signals.
And PTMs are like the traffic lights and the street signs directing all the action.
Yeah, perfect analogy. They're the versatile regulatory switches that keep everything running smoothly.
Wow. So when a cell like encounters a hormone or is under stress, PTMs allow for this rapid and fine-tuned response.
Right.
By modifying existing proteins, it doesn't have to go back to the DNA and create new ones.
It's much more efficient that way.
That's amazing. So where do these modifications happen?
They occur at very specific locations on the protein, particular amino acid side chains, or the peptide bonds that link them together.
And this isn't random, right?
No, not at all. There's a dedicated system of enzymes within our cells that do this.
Okay.
We're talking about kinases and phosphatases that add and remove phosphate groups, transferases and ligases that attach other molecules and proteases that cut the protein backbone.
So many different players.
There are. And Thermo Fisher mentioned that roughly 5% of our proteome is made up of these modifying enzymes.
Wow, 5%.
That's a significant chunk. It really speaks to how important and prevalent these modifications are.
And what's really cool is that some proteins can even modify themselves.
Oh, yeah, that's right. They have these things called autocatalytic domains.
Autocatalytic domains.
It's like they have a built-in tool to adjust their own settings.
It's amazing. And these modifications, they can happen at any point in a protein's life cycle.
Yeah, pretty much.
During folding to guide it to the right location after it's fully folded and active.
Mm-hmm.
Or even as a signal to degrade the protein.
Exactly. It's a continuous process.
And sometimes it's not just a one-time event, is it?
No, you're right. Some proteins go through these stepwise maturation processes.
Oh, okay.
Involving combinations of cleavages and the addition of different groups.
So it's like going through a series of upgrades to reach their final form.
Precisely.
And some PTMs are reversible, which is so important for dynamic regulation.
It is. For example, phosphorylation.
Right.
Kinases add the phosphate group, and that often changes the protein's activity or its interactions.
Mm-hmm.
And then phosphatases can remove it, flipping the switch back.
Like turning a light on and off.
Exactly. But other modifications like proteolytic cleavage are irreversible.
Oh, okay.
Once that peptide bond is broken, it's permanent.
So we've talked about what PTMs are and why they're important for protein diversity and regulation.
Right.
Now let's dive into some of the common types.
Okay.
First up is phosphorylation.
Yeah, that's a big one.
It seems to be a star player in the PTM world.
It is. Protein Tech highlights it as the most extensively studied PTM. And they estimate that about one-third of all proteins in mammals get phosphorylated at some point.
Wow, one-third. That's a lot.
It is.
So what actually happens during phosphorylation?
Well, a phosphate group is added.
A phosphate group.
Yeah, that's one phosphorus atom with four oxygen atoms around it, and it carries a negative charge.
Okay.
And this is added to specific amino acids, mainly serine, threonine, or tyrosine, but sometimes it can be histidine too.
And Khan Academy explained that this process is carried out by enzymes.
Right.
Protein kinases add the phosphate and protein phosphatases remove it.
Exactly. And this balance between the two is really important for controlling so many processes in the cell.
So phosphorylation is a master regulator then?
It is. It's involved in pretty much every aspect of cell biology.
Wow.
From cell cycle control and growth to cell death and signal transduction pathways.
Mm-hmm.
It also affects enzyme activity protein interactions and even where proteins are located in the cell.
So it's involved in how cells communicate and respond to their environment too?
Exactly.
Thermo Fisher Scientific actually showed a practical example of this using Western blot analysis.
Oh, right.
They demonstrated how to enrich for phosphorylated proteins from cancer cells using special kits and antibodies.
That's really helpful for researchers studying PTMs in normal and disease states.
It is. And another interesting thing is that ATP, the cell's main energy currency, is the phosphate donor.
Right. ATP provides the phosphate group for the reaction.
Okay. Moving on to another key player, we have glycosylation.
Yeah. This one involves attaching sugar molecules to proteins.
Sugar molecules?
Yeah. It can be simple sugars like monosaccharides or complex chains called polysaccharides.
And this can really impact a protein's structure, right?
It can. It affects how it folds, its stability, its interactions, and even its activity.
Khan Academy called it one of the most significant and widespread types of PTMs.
Yeah, they're right.
And Thermo Fisher pointed out that glycosylation is especially important for proteins on the cell surface or those that are secreted.
That's right.
So in eukaryotes, there are two main types. N-linked and O-linked glycosylation.
Mm-hmm. N-linked is where the sugar attaches to an asparagine.
Okay.
And O-linked is where it attaches to a serine or threonine.
And there are some less common types too, right?
Yeah, like C-linked glycosylation, glypiation, which involves a lipid anchor, and phosphoglycosylation.
Where both sugar and phosphate are added.
Exactly.
Protein Tech mentioned that a lot of proteins that are made on ribosomes attached to the endoplasmic reticulum undergo glycosylation.
Right.
And Khan Academy give a good example. The glycoproteins on red blood cells determine our ABO blood types.
Oh, that's right.
They also said that these sugar chains or glycans are like checkpoints during protein trafficking in the ER,
yeah,
making sure proteins are folded and processed correctly.
It's like quality control for the protein.
Exactly. Oh. Now, let's talk about ubiquitination.
Right.
This one involves attaching a small protein called ubiquitin to other proteins.
Ubiquitin is about 8 kilodaltons in size.
And Khan Academy explained that ubiquitination often tags a protein for degradation.
Yeah, it's like putting a sticker on it that says, recycle me.
So when a protein gets polyubiquitinated, meaning multiple ubiquitins are attached, it's recognized by the proteasome, which breaks down the protein.
Right.
And the ubiquitin is released to be used again.
It's a very efficient system.
It is. But Protein Tech mentioned that ubiquitination does more than just degrade proteins.
Yeah, it's also involved in cell signaling, internalization of membrane proteins, and even gene regulation and development.
It's a busy little protein.
It is.
Thermo Fisher even talked about their kits that can detect ubiquitinated proteins better than other methods.
That's helpful for researchers.
It is. And the process of attaching ubiquitin is quite complex.
Yeah, it involves a cascade of enzymes.
What kind of enzymes?
E1 activating enzymes, E2 conjugating enzymes, and E3 ligases.
Wow.
They make sure that ubiquitin is attached to the right proteins.
So it's not just randomly degrading everything.
Yes.
Okay, next up is S-nitrosylation.
This one involves nitric oxide.
Nitric oxide, or NO.
Yeah, it reacts with free cysteine amino acids in a protein.
To form S-nitrothiols, or SNOs.
Right.
And Thermo Fisher said this is a reversible PTM.
Yeah, it is.
And cells use it to regulate protein stability gene expression and even as a way to store and release NO.
It's quite versatile.
But SNOs are quite reactive and have a short lifespan in the cytoplasm.
Yeah, there are enzymes that can remove the NO group.
So the cell has to be strategic about where these SNOs are located?
It does.
Thermo Fisher mentioned that they're often found in membranes, vesicles, or hydrophobic pockets of proteins.
Right.
They gave the example of caspases, which are involved in programmed cell death.
Mm-hmm.
These caspases are stored in mitochondria as inactive SNOs and then activated when the NO is removed.
It's a clever way to control their activity.
And S-nitrosylation is very specific. It targets particular cysteines.
It does.
But detecting them can be tricky.
Yeah, because proteins can have many cysteines, and SNOs are short-lived.
But there are methods like the biotin switch assay.
Right.
And Thermo Fisher even offers kits for detecting S-nitrosylated proteins.
That's great for researchers.
It is. Let's move on to methylation.
Okay.
This one involves adding a methyl group to proteins.
A methyl group is just one carbon with 3 hydrogens.
And Khan Academy said this can increase a protein's hydrophobicity.
Right. Making it more likely to interact with membranes.
Or other hydrophobic environments.
Yeah. And it can also neutralize a negative charge.
And methylation is done by enzymes called methyltransferases.
Right.
Which use a molecule called SAM as the methyl donor.
SAM stands for S-adosyl methionine.
Thermo Fisher mentioned that SAM is very important in the cell.
It is. It's one of the most used molecules after ATP.
And methylation can be irreversible or reversible.
Right. Methylation on nitrogen N-methylation is usually irreversible.
But methylation on oxygen O-methylation can be reversed.
Exactly.
And we often hear about methylation in epigenetics.
Yeah. Where histones which package our DNA can be methylated.
And this affects gene expression.
Right. Thermo Fisher showed a diagram of different PTMs on histones.
And interestingly, a single amino acid can have multiple methyl groups added.
Yeah. That can really amplify its effects.
Okay, let's talk about N-acetylation.
This involves adding an acetyl group to a nitrogen atom.
An acetyl group.
It's a small group with a carbonyl and a methyl group.
And Thermo Fisher explained that this happens in almost all eukaryotic proteins.
It does.
Through both irreversible and reversible mechanisms.
That's right.
So N-terminal acetylation happens during protein synthesis.
Yeah, it's co-translational.
So an enzyme removes the initial methionine, and then another enzyme adds the acetyl group using acetyl-CoA.
Exactly.
Interestingly, 80-90% of eukaryotic proteins undergo N-terminal acetylation.
That's a lot.
But its exact function isn't always clear.
Right. We're still learning about it.
But acetylation also happens on lysine residues of histones.
Yeah, and this is reversible.
And very important for gene regulation.
It is.
Thermo Fisher and Khan Academy both said that acetylation usually opens up the chromatin structure,
right,
making the DNA more accessible for transcription.
It's done by enzymes called HATs histone acetyltransferases.
And the reverse is done by HEPs histone deacetylases.
Right.
Including sirtuins.
Yes, sirtuins are a fascinating class of deacetylases.
And it seems that acetylation isn't limited to histones anymore?
No, it's been found on other proteins too.
Suggesting broader roles.
Yeah, beyond just gene expression.
And Thermo Fisher mentioned that acetylation can crosstalk with other PTMs.
Right.
Like phosphorylation, ubiquitination, and methylation.
Adding another layer of complexity.
Exactly. And researchers use techniques like ChIP chromatin immunoprecipitation.
Mm-hmm.
And mass spectrometry to study acetylation.
Those are powerful tools.
They are. Now let's move on to lipidation.
Right.
This involves attaching lipids to proteins.
Lipids are fats and oils.
And these modifications usually target proteins to membranes, like the ER, Golgi, mitochondria, vesicles, or the plasma membrane.
Exactly.
Thermo Fisher outlined four main types.
Okay, let's hear them.
First, there are GPI anchors, glycosylphosphatidylinositol anchors.
GPI anchors.
They're complex lipids that are pre-assembled in the ER,
mm-hmm,
and then attached to the C-terminus of a protein.
Okay.
This tethers the protein to the plasma membrane.
Right.
They often cluster in lipid rafts, which are cholesterol-rich areas.
Interesting.
And an enzyme called phospholipase C can cleave the GPI anchor.
So it's reversible.
Yes, the protein can be released from the membrane.
Okay.
Then there's N-myristoylation.
N-myristoylation.
This adds a 14-carbon fatty acid called myristoyl to the N-terminus.
To a glycine residue specifically.
Right.
And this happens after the initial methionine is removed.
Showing how multiple PTMs can happen to one protein.
That's right.
And this myristoyl group gives the protein an affinity for membranes.
But it's usually temporary.
Thermo Fisher described it as a conformational switch.
A way to control its localization.
Exactly. Then there's S-palmitoylation.
S-palmitoylation.
Which adds a 16-carbon fatty acid called palmitoyl to cysteine residues.
Via a thioester bond.
Right. And because palmitoyl is longer and more hydrophobic, it creates a stronger membrane anchor.
But it can be reversed by enzymes called thioesterases.
So another on-off switch.
Yeah.
Thoma Fisher also said that S-palmitoylation often strengthens other lipid modifications.
Right.
And helps concentrate proteins in lipid RAF.
It's all about fine-tuning the protein's location and interactions.
Exactly. Finally, there's S-prenylation.
S-prenylation.
This adds either a 15-carbon farnesyl or a 20-carbon geranyl-geranyl group to cysteines.
Near the C-terminus.
And unlike palmitoylation, prenylation is quite stable.
Right. It's considered a permanent modification.
Thermo Fisher said that about 2% of proteins are prenylated.
Wow, 2%.
Including the RAS family, which are important for signaling.
They are.
And prenylation can be part of a multi-step PTM process.
Involving cleavage and methylation, too.
It's amazing how much complexity there is.
It is.
Okay, let's talk about proteolysis.
This is the breaking of peptide bonds.
The bonds that hold amino acids together.
Exactly.
It might seem destructive.
Yeah, but it's actually highly regulated and crucial.
Thermo Fisher explained that proteases are the enzymes that do this.
Right.
And there are so many different types.
There are.
With different specificities and mechanisms. So what are some of the roles of proteolysis?
Well, it's important for antigen processing in the immune system.
Okay.
Apoptosis, or programmed cell death.
Mm-hmm.
Shedding proteins from the cell surface and cell signaling.
So it's involved in a lot of important processes.
It is.
Thermo Fisher also talked about two types of proteolysis.
Right.
Degradative and biosynthetic.
Degradative proteolysis removes misfolded or damaged proteins.
Oh, right.
And maintains cellular homeostasis.
Like keeping things in balance.
Exactly.
And biosynthetic proteolysis cleaves signal peptides or activates inactive enzymes called zymogens.
Which is like turning on a switch.
Right.
Converting the protein into its active form.
Thermo Fisher gave the example of insulin maturation.
Oh.
Where a larger precursor protein is cleaved to make the active hormone.
It's a classic example of how proteolysis can be used to regulate protein function.
And while breaking peptide bonds is easy energetically, The activity of proteases is tightly controlled.
It has to be.
They can be classified by where they act on the protein chain.
Right.
Like aminopeptidases and carboxypeptidases.
Or by the type of chemical group in their active site.
So there are serine proteases, cysteine proteases, aspartic acid proteases, and metalloproteases.
And most proteases fall into those categories.
Lastly, we have protein splicing.
Yeah, this one's a bit different.
Khan Academy said it's where a specific sequence within a protein called an intine is removed.
That intine.
And the slanking sequences called extines are joined together.
It's like splicing RNA, but with proteins.
And intines can even have enzymatic activity.
Right.
And catalyze their own removal.
Their cell splicing.
Khan Academy mentioned that protein splicing is more common in lower eukaryotes and bacteria.
Right.
Especially in response to stress or in DNA replication and repair genes.
Interesting.
But they said it hasn't been observed in humans.
So it seems to be an ancient mechanism that's been lost in some lineages.
Okay, so we've seen a wide range of PTMs and their effects on proteins.
Yeah.
And Thermo Fisher emphasized that these modifications are important for cell biology.
Right.
And implicated in many diseases.
They are.
Which brings us to the link between PTMs and human health. So analyzing PTMs has become really important for understanding diseases.
Yeah.
Like heart disease, cancer, neurodegenerative diseases, and diabetes.
Right. Both Thermo Fisher and ProteinTech highlighted that.
But studying PTMs and disease isn't always easy, right?
No, it's not.
There are challenges in developing specific tools.
Yeah, to detect, identify, and purify these modifications.
But luckily, Thermo Fisher said that proteomics technologies were helping us overcome these challenges.
That's good news.
It is. And the discussions on Science Direct gave some specific examples.
Oh, interesting. What were they?
They talked about polyglutamine repeat diseases like Huntington's disease.
Okay.
Where PTMs of these disease proteins can affect their toxicity by influencing things like cleavage, aggregation, protein interactions, and localization.
Right.
And several PTMs are involved, like phosphorylation, ubiquitination, S-moylation, acetylation, and S-nitrosylation.
Wow, that's a lot.
It is. And proteolytic cleavage of these proteins is a key step in the disease process.
So PTMs are really at the heart of the problem.
They are. Science Direct also brought up systemic lupus erythematosus, or SLE.
SLE.
An autoimmune disease.
Right.
Where PTMs can create new self-antigens.
Self-antigens.
Yeah, proteins that the immune system attacks by mistake.
Oh, I see.
For example, changes in asparagin or aspartic acid residues, dimethylarginines and SNRNPs, small nuclear ribonuclear proteins.
Right.
And changes in phosphorylation of SR proteins.
All of these can contribute to SLE.
Right. They also talked about steroid hormone receptors.
Oh, right.
Which are important for many processes.
They are.
And Science Direct said that their function is heavily affected by PTMs.
So which PTMs affect them?
Well, phosphorylation, myristoylation, palmitoylation, S-U-moylation, ubiquitination, proteolysis, and even disulfide bond formation.
Wow, that's a long list.
It is. And these modifications can affect the receptor stability, interactions, localization, and even its ability to bind hormones.
It's amazing how much control PTMs have over these receptors.
It is. Science Direct also mentioned how infectious agents can manipulate PTMs.
Oh, interesting. How so?
They gave the example of Listeria monocytogenes.
Listeria.
Which is a bacteria that can cause infections.
Right.
And they said that Listeria not only triggers changes in the host cell's PTMs,
mm-hmm.
but it also co-opts the host's PTM machinery for its own survival.
So it hijacks the system.
Exactly. And even some bacterial proteins can be modified by the host's PTM systems.
It's like a battle for control over the PTMs.
So we've seen that PTMs are essential for protein function.
Right.
And that disruptions can lead to diseases.
Yeah.
But let's go back to that idea of how PTMs create protein diversity.
Okay.
Even though we have a limited number of genes.
Right.
It all comes down to the fact that a single protein can have many different modifications.
Mm.
And each modification can change its properties and functions.
It's like having a basic Lego brick that you can attach different things to,
right,
creating a huge variety of structures.
Khan Academy and ProteinTech both said this is a key evolutionary strategy.
It is. It allows organisms to expand their proteome without needing more genes.
So one protein might have several phosphorylation sites.
Right.
And the combination of which sites are phosphorylated can have different effects.
It's like a code.
And then you add glycosylation, acetylation, ubiquitination, and all the other PTMs.
And the possibilities explode.
It's amazing.
It is.
So PTMs can act as switches turning protein activity on or off.
Right.
They can change a protein's shape so it can bind different molecules.
Mm-hmm.
They can act as zip codes directing proteins to specific locations.
Like a cellular GPS.
And they can tag proteins for degradation.
It's a remarkable system.
It is. Okay. The learner. Let's unpack all of this. You came to us wanting a shortcut to being well-informed.
Yep.
And I hope this deep dive into PTMs has done that for you. You should now appreciate the complexity and control that PTMs add to our biology.
Right.
It's incredible how the same protein can be modified in so many ways to do different things.
Yeah.
In different parts of the cell at different times.
It's amazing how much one protein can do.
And understanding this helps you see why a single genetic mutation can have such big effects.
Right.
Because it might disrupt a crucial PTM.
And that can have a domino effect on other processes.
Exactly. But understanding PTMs isn't just an academic exercise.
No, it's not.
As we've discussed, they're involved in many diseases.
Right.
And knowing how PTMs go wrong can help us develop new diagnostic tools and therapies.
Yeah, that's the exciting part.
So imagine drugs that can block a specific phosphorylation event in cancer cells,
mm-hmm.
or therapies that correct protein misfolding caused by incorrect glycosylation.
That's the future of medicine.
That